So Matthew 1, verses 1 to 17. This is the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, Judah the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar, Perez the father of Hezron, Hezron the father of Ram, Ram the father of Amminadab, Amminadab the father of Nahshon, Nahshon the father of Salmon, Salmon the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab, Boaz the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth, Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of King David. David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. Solomon, the father of Rehoboam. Rehoboam, the father of Abijah. Abijah, the father of Asa. Asa, the father of Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat, the father of Jehoram. Jehoram, the father of Uzziah. Uzziah, the father of Jotham. Jotham, the father of Ahaz. Ahaz, the father of Hezekiah. Hezekiah, the father of Manasseh. Manasseh, the father of Amon. Amon, the father of Josiah. And Josiah, the father of Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the exile to Babylon. After the exile to Babylon, Jeconiah was the father of Shealtiel. Shealtiel, the father of Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel, the father of Abihud. Abihud, the father of Eliakim. Eliakim, the father of Azor. Azor, the father of Zadok. Zadok, the father of Akim. Akim, the father of Elihud. Elihud, the father of Eleazar. Eleazar, the father of Mathan. Mathan, the father of Jacob. And Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary. And Mary was the mother of Jesus, who is called the Messiah. Thus there were 14 generations in all from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the exile to Babylon, and 14 from the exile to the Messiah.
Thank you very much there, Ian. That's not one which trips off the tongue very easily, is it? But we appreciate all the hard work that's gone into reading that. Now, we may know the joy of good leadership, either in the home or the church or the work or in our country as well, but we may also be able to guess the horrors of bad leadership. We've seen it play out before our eyes in Afghanistan. Since the forces pulled out of there, the Taliban returned, and poverty has increased from 47% to 97%. Women are deprived of many or any rights. Foreign aid was prevented, which has crippled the healthcare system. And public flogging and executions have returned. Which does little, does it, to tell the story of a father struggling to try and scrape together a living for his family, of a wife sat at home, fearful to leave the house without her husband with her, a child starving to death. Bad leadership is a living hell. And that makes Matthew 1:1 an explosive headline. See, the chances are, if we were to try and write a best-selling novel, we probably wouldn't decide to start it off with a genealogy of names which we don't really know. But Matthew does, and oddly enough, for his first audience, this headline would have had copies just flying off the shelf. This is big news. Matthew 1:1 says, "This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham." See, for a long time, God's people had suffered under no leadership. They'd suffered under bad leadership, and they'd suffered under foreign leadership, and yet held on to a promise that one day a king would come, a good king, a king like David. And it's interesting, isn't it? Just as a little aside, how a promise like that has found its way into lots of our most famous stories. Robin Hood is a story of awaiting the good King Richard to return. King Arthur promises to return at England's hour of need. The story of Narnia is awaiting Aslan's return. The Lord of the Rings has the title, The Return of the King. Deep down, this longing for a leadership, for a king, chimes within us. But Matthew announces the king is now here. The first thing Matthew wants to teach us is that God has now kept his promise to provide a leader, to provide a king. And now that promise was made a long time ago, a long time even before King David arrived. In Genesis 17:6, God says to Abraham, I will make you very fruitful. I will make nations of you. We're quite familiar with that part of the promise. But he also says, and kings will come from you. We don't often associate Abraham with kingship, do we? But in a way, he does act like a king, almost like a tribal leader doing things that kings do. He goes to war. He judges, he rules, he provides hospitality. In Abraham, we have the seeds of leadership, which would one day grow into kingship. And from that point on, we're watching each and every one of his children to see which one is going to be the king. I think that's why this family tree goes on and is traced through Judah rather than Reuben. Reuben was his firstborn, or even traced through Joseph. We know Joseph is quite prominent in the story, but the line that's taken is through Judah. And I think that's because when Jacob is handing out blessings at the end of his life, he blesses his son Judah by saying, the scepter, the rule, will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he to whom it belongs shall come, and the obedience of nations shall be his. These promises act like a bit of a narrowing of a funnel. They were looking for a king from Abraham's line, but more specifically then from Judah's line. Then that narrows down to Jesse of the tribe of Judah, and then that spotlight finds its way onto Jesse's youngest son, David. Verse 5 takes us from Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar, Perez the father of Hezron, Hezron the father of Ram, Ram the father of Amminadab, Amminadab the father of Nahshon, Nahshon the father of Salmon, Salmon the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab, Boaz the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth, Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of King David. Ruth and Boaz were both alive at the time of Judges, where the book of Judges repeatedly reminds us Israel had no king and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. They're longing for a king to come, one who would lead them to God. And at last we find that in David. David is the first high point in this genealogy. He's the only one here who's actually called king. He's the one who forms the mold, this template, which all other kings would follow. This is the time Israel will look back on as the glory days of their nation. Perhaps a little bit like England looks back on the Victorian era as the time when Britain was booming, when she ruled the waves and led the world in terms of technology and empire. As we know, England's empire made its mistakes, as too did David. In the very same verse, there's a hint of his great shame. David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. Well, David slept with another man's wife and had him murdered in order to cover up the evidence. As good as David was, well, he's not the king we're looking for. In fact, God speaks to David and promises him that there's another one to come. He tells him to look forward for him as well and magnifies the blessings that surround him. In 2 Samuel 7, the Lord declares to David that the Lord himself will establish a house for you. When your days are over and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up one of your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom. Your house and your kingdom shall endure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. this king would lead them into a time of peace and prosperity that they've never experienced before. And what's more, it would go on forever. But as high and as grand as these promises are, each successive child, each successive king falls further and further from the mark. Well, Solomon, he was wise, wasn't he? But he had many foreign wives who led him astray from God. Rehoboam was a fool who imposed a harsh burden on his subjects. He follows the advice of his young men and says, well, my father made your yoke heavy. I'm going to make it heavier still. My father scourged you with whips. Well, I'm going to scourge you with scorpions. I'm not sure quite how that worked, but I'm sure he found a way. It's because of him, Israel is split in two, that the northern kingdoms are torn away from his grasp. Abijah followed the religious policy of Rehoboam. Asa, well, he did remove some of the high places, some of the places where they were worshipping idols, but later failed to trust God. And so the latter part of his reign was marred by illness and war. Jehoshaphat was a good king, but his good work was undone by his son Jehoram. And Jehoram's obituary is funny in a darkly tragic way. You wouldn't want 2 Chronicles 21:20 carved onto your headstone. The lasting memory we have of him is that it says he passed away to no one's regret. The list goes on. Some are good, but never good enough. Never good enough to stop the long, slow decline into sin and exile. At verse 11, and Josiah, the father of Jeconiah, and his brothers at the time of the exile to Babylon, which is the end of God's people having their own king. It appears like God's promises have failed. The scepter had departed from Judah, and David's line would not be established forever. An oppressive and foreign rule does them no favors at all. From the time of Babylon onwards, from the time of the genealogy where Jeconiah is, we don't know a great deal about the people coming after that. But we do know generally what was happening in the area. And the whole process of exile was a traumatic one for God's people, for Jerusalem. Earlier on in the year, we looked at that, didn't we, as we read through Lamentations and felt just some of their grief and some of their sorrow at what had happened. They'd been deported to Babylon. Even when they did return, she was still subject to Persian rule till the time of Alexander the Great, who again, he tried to stamp his mark upon them. He tried to make the whole world Greek in its culture, and so they bore the scars from him until the time he died, and his kingdom was divided up between his generals, Ptolemy and Seleucus, established the Ptolemaic and Seleucid Empire, and Judea became a kind of frontier land between these two warring factions. Anytime they wanted to attack each other, well, they'd march over Judah or try and take that land from each other. They did enjoy a bit of freedom under the Hasmonean era, only to be crushed again underneath Rome's jackboot moments later. Rome desecrated the temple and installed Herod, an Edomite, as king. Any attempt to escape was crushed mercilessly. By the time Jesus arrives, Judah was well and truly on her knees with little strength to get back up, save a promise that one day a king would come, a son of David, which, as I mentioned, makes Matthew 1:1 big news. This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David. Our eyes just glance over that title, don't they? The Messiah or the Christ, sometimes we think of it almost like a surname. But the Messiah or Christ means the king, the anointed one. This is front page news. The king is here. This is the genealogy of Jesus, the king, which is a claim that needs a little bit of backing up. You may or you may not know that there's a man in Australia, Simon Durante Day, who claims to be the child of King Charles III. He was born in England on the 5th of April 1966. At 8 months old, he was adopted by a couple who used to work. His grandparents both worked for the Queen. And in photos, he does bear a passing resemblance to King Charles. I think we've got the photo there. You judge for yourself quite how strong his claim to the throne is there. I'm not sure there's more to it. But if we wanted to know, we'd have to get a DNA test, a paternity test for him, wouldn't he? But if we did get one, you could imagine that would be front page news. This paternity test would be plastered all over the front page, so we could see that evidence right there for ourselves. And that's what Matthew's doing with this family tree. Genealogy is like the paternity test of the day that proves that he's the true heir to David's throne. And now we don't have the documents that this genealogy was based on, but up until about AD 70, the Jews did keep really accurate records of genealogies, particularly when it came to kings and promises. And so this is actually likely to be very reliable within the framework of how genealogies work. Now, sometimes people will compare this to the genealogy in Luke and say, oh, there's loads of differences here. But we don't need to worry about that. It's more than possible, isn't it, to trace a family, a line of a family tree through a different branch from time to time, and that would explain some of the differences. And a brother at those times, if a husband died, a brother would sometimes take his brother's wife into his home to provide children or heirs for that family name. That's the idea of a levirate marriage, isn't it, that we see at play in the book of Ruth. That might explain for some of the other differences as well. We also don't need to worry that it's been abbreviated. When we call Jesus the son of David, that doesn't mean his literal son, does it? It means his great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great grandson and so on. Just so in the genealogy, we take it for granted that it doesn't actually have to be the literal father. Josiah wasn't actually the father of Jeconiah. He was his granddad, but he still sired him. He still begat him in that way. Genealogies were often abbreviated in those days to save on space, really, or to aid with memorization. But the point Matthew is making is that God has now kept his promise of a leader. God always keeps his promises. Perhaps not in the way that we might expect, or perhaps not running to the time frame that we'd like. But God never forgets a word he's spoken. Not one of them will fail. And we need that perspective today, don't we? Particularly when it comes to prayer. If we're praying in line with God's promises, then we can trust he will answer. Maybe not in our lifetime, maybe not in the way that we'd expect, but he never forgets the words that he's bound himself to. But another aspect of this long genealogy is to make us realize just how good the good news is. We maybe got a flavor as we rattled through just what a rough time Judah has had, just how they'd suffered underneath that bad leadership. They'd endured no leadership, awful leadership, and oppressive foreign leadership for at least 2,000 years now. This genealogy should make us rejoice in verse 1 that at last a king is here. At last a king like David, a good king. This is better than King Richard, King Arthur, Aslan and Aragorn all rolled into one. Here is one who stands, the one who stands at the end of this line, stands in contrast to all those who'd come before him. If Rehoboam's policy was to make the yoke heavier still and to scourge people with scorpions, well, Jesus' policy is wholly different. He says in Matthew 11, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Instead of scourging people with whips or with scorpions, well, he turns his own back to be whipped for them. In Matthew 9, David's son has tender mercy upon a blind man. In Matthew 12, David's son teaches with wonderful authority. In Matthew 15, David's son liberates a man from evil. Jesus is God's promised leader, and that news is incredibly good. Incredibly good news for us today. Jesus' leadership is not abusive, never toxic, never self-serving. He only does what is good for us. Interestingly enough, David's last words were actually a song about how good leadership is. 2 Samuel 23, 2 says, "The Spirit of the Lord spoke through me. His word was on my tongue. The God of Israel spoke. The Rock of Israel said to me, when one rules over people in righteousness, when he rules in the fear of God, he is like the light of morning at sunrise on a cloudless morning, like brightness after rain that brings grass from the earth." Well, that's Jesus' leadership. He leads us out of darkness into a new dawn, bright and clear. He blows the storm clouds away. His leadership allows for growth and flourishing like grass springing from trampled earth. And perhaps we need to hear that again this evening. It's easy to become cynical towards leadership. Human leadership will often let us down, and it's easier to turn and just try and listen to our own voice rather than another. But if we read through Matthew, we need to realize again, it should restore our faith in Jesus' leadership. Matthew 11:21 says, "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart. And if you follow me, you will find rest for your souls." But even without reading on, I think the genealogy has given us a few pointers to that already. This genealogy hints of God's grace and his mercy. Grace and mercy are two related ideas, but slightly different, aren't they? God's grace is his undeserved kindness towards us. And we see that right the way from the start. Abraham was a nobody, wasn't he? He was a foreigner wandering through the land of Ur. And yet God promised him more than just kingship. He promised him that he would be blessed. And more than that, that through him all nations would be blessed. Genesis 12, 2 and 3. "I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." And that's what we see happening, isn't it? At strategic points in the genealogy. Don't you find it remarkable just who Matthew decides to include and who actually he hasn't included? Of course, he could have included some of the famous matriarchs of Israel, Sarah and Rebecca and Rachel, but he doesn't. Instead, he includes Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and Bathsheba. The uniting factor behind them is that they're all women. Remarkable enough, usually women wouldn't crop up in these genealogies, but they are. And they're also foreign. Tamar was from Ur. Rahab was one of the Canaanites who'd harbored the spies when they were scouting out the land of Jericho. Ruth was a Moabitess, and Bathsheba, well, she was an Israelite, but she'd married a Hittite, Uriah the Hittite, which had made her foreign. Each of them is a little nod towards God's blessing the nations, blessing Gentiles perhaps like you and me. That theme gets developed then in a big way throughout Matthew, doesn't it? As we see all kinds of foreigners coming to Jesus and being blessed by the son of Abraham. And then that theme comes into land at the very end as Jesus is risen and ascended and says, "Well, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations." It's through this son of Abraham that all nations are blessed. If I can put it this way, Jesus isn't just good news for the men of Israel, he's good news for the women of Kendal. We too can be blessed as we follow this king. See, immigration has been a big story, hasn't it, throughout the news this last year. People seeking a better life and being shut out and sent away. And don't get me wrong, I realise just what a thorny issue it is, and I don't envy whoever it is who has to decide on it. But the news forms a contrast to Jesus and his kingdom. Jesus throws the door open to Hittites and Moabites and Canaanites and Urites, if that's a thing. He throws the door open to aliens and exiles and strangers and foreigners. Those who trust him, those who throw in their lot with his people, will never be turned from his gates. Another tragically uniting factor behind these women is the hint of sexual scandal. Three of them were the victims or the willing participants of sexual sin. Tamar slept with her father-in-law. Rahab was a prostitute. Bathsheba slept with King David whilst she was married. Even Ruth, really, her husband, Mahlon, well, he was an Israelite and shouldn't really have married a foreigner. She's only there because of sin, which reminds us of God's mercy. If God's grace is his kindness, is his giving us what we don't deserve, well, his mercy is not giving us what we do deserve. And as I was reading through the background for this sermon, I read a little bit about each of the characters in this list. And behind each and every one, there was sin. All of them had sin in their lives. Even the patriarchs. Abraham had lied about his wife in order to save his own skin. Likewise, Isaac had passed his wife off as his sister. Jacob had tricked his birthright out of his brother. And none of the kings, as we've been thinking, were any better. And so as well as giving us a long lesson in God's grace, the genealogy also gives us a long lesson in his mercy, his willingness to forgive the guilty. Which takes us to the very heart of why this king is good news. That's explained just a few verses later in verse 21. She will give birth to a son, and you are to give him the name Jesus, because he will save his people from their sins. In the same way that it's easy to just let our eyes glide over the title Christ or Messiah, it's easy to let our eyes glide over the name Jesus. But it's significant. It means the Lord saves. This is the genealogy of Jesus. The Lord saves. Never has such a saviour been so needed. The genealogy is one long catalogue of sinner after sinner after sinner after sinner after sinner after sinner after sinner. Their sins have been written large over the last 2,000 years of history, 46 times. The genealogy hammers this home. This people have a problem with sin. But astonishingly, Jesus is not ashamed to come from this line. I don't know whether you've traced your family history back very far. My father had a summer a few years ago of tracing our family history back, and I was so excited to try and find someone who was famous, maybe a king or maybe a nice inheritance heading my way. But we found nothing. To be honest, we found thieves and adulterers, people who actually we'd probably want to distance from. But Jesus doesn't. He enters the line of sinful man, not a sinner himself, but willing to associate with them, to be called their brother and their friend. That's how Matthew describes Jesus' life and ministry. He hangs out, he eats with tax collectors and sinners. He hangs out with the leprous and the adulterers. Even in his last moments, he's hung between two rebels on a cross. Carrying upon himself the sins of the world, he saves his people from their sins. We too can rejoice in his patience, in his mercy from generation to generation. Israel's history is a catalogue of the most heinous and the most besetting of sins. And yet Jesus still came for them into that line to redeem that line. And if that's true of them, well, that's true of us as well. The most heinous and besetting sins can be and will be forgiven at the cross. What Jesus is offering here is a fresh start. There are hints here of Genesis. A more literal translation of verse 1 would read, "The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ," which has the ring of Genesis 5:1. This is the book of the generations of Adam. Matthew's making the subtle but significant claim, this is a completely fresh start. Just as Adam was the first in his line, a sinful line, well, Jesus is the first of a new line, a sinless line. A line of sinners who've had their sins washed clean at the cross and enjoy his leadership as king forevermore. Matthew begins with an explosive headline. This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Praise God. We're going to praise God now as we turn again to song, and we're going to sing a song that tells the story of Jesus' life.